And W cross section, Z cross section, but the most important thing is the top cross section. You know, top TT bar cross section is very small at 2 TB, yeah? But at 14 TB, it is, I don't know, it's 100 times bigger. And that really helps, you know. The LHC has much higher luminosity, you know, 100 times higher luminosity than Tevatron, and 100 times higher cross-section for TT bar, okay? So it's very important. And it is true, even, you know, bigger ratio appears if something even heavier is there, okay? Like a Higgs boson of 500 GeV, you know, it goes this way, I don't know, maybe three or four orders higher, okay? If you think like, you know, Skok or Duinos of 500 GeV or so, then the ratio is, you know, I cannot imagine, you know, it's just impossible to produce it at the Pevatron, but at the LHC, you will find them very copiously. So, this is my note. you know, I don't remember too many things, but whenever I need to do some calculations, I often do all the calculations when I do, you know, I have plenty of time. And usually when I have plenty of time, I don't have any textbook, anything. Okay? I just myself and maybe pen and paper is necessary. Sometimes a small calculator. Then that's sufficient to calculate everything. If you remember some key points, and I just want to tell you how I calculate those things. And of course, you need to know the length units. 1 millimeter, you know, micron, nanometer, probably up to the everybody knows. Yeah? Nanometer is the present day technological frontier. So we often hear nanotechnology, right? Then picometer, and then femtometer. And femtometer is very, very popular for physicists because it is essentially the size of nuclei, okay? Nucleon. It is the size of strong interactions. The size of nuclei or size of strong interaction, which of the strong interaction is determined by the mass of the pion. That's how Professor Yukawa predicted the existence of the pion and its mass correctly. Because beforehand, he knew the range of strong interaction is 1 centimeter. Okay? And that knowledge I learned when I was a high school student. So I never forget it. And so I use this knowledge to relate length scale to the inverse of the electron volt scale. Because, you know, we always use a natural unit where C, light speed of light is 1, and reduced Planck constant, H over 2 pi, is 1. But it's rather difficult. I mean, speed of light I roughly remember, but H over 2 pi, not so easy to remember. Okay? Very rather difficult, isn't it? So, rather than remembering those things, I remember just this relationship. You don't forget this. well, pion mass is 140 MeV. And actually, it is 200 MeV inverse. It's approximately 1 femtometer. Okay? And so you can remember anywhere, but this is how I remember. And this is very useful because I can also tell what the cross-section is. Because hadronic cross-section is just the size really the cross section of hadrons. Okay? So, cross section of hadron is pi r squared. You know this. We don't forget this. Okay? Pi r squared. And r is essentially 1 femtometer. So this is the hadron cross section. And it is about pi, well, 1 femtometer squared is 10 millibar. And if you doubt, you just check with all the total cross section numbers, and you find that it's about, you know, pi, proton-proton is maybe total cross section is about 50 milligram. Pion-nucleon is slightly smaller. In any case, it's something around here. And so actually you don't, I can also remember this because I remember several, a few tenths of milligram as total cross section. So of course you need to remember several things. But if you just remember these two things, everything is just straightforward. You don't make mistakes. And then once you know millibound, this is the identification. You know, 10 to the minus 30 square meter is 10 millibound. This is the unit of the cross section. And then you find that one femtobound is 10 to the minus 39 square centimeter. So in any case, once you know this and this, that's sufficient to know everything. So cross-section unit, I just repeat, 10 to the minus, so 1 femtobound squared is 200 MeV squared inverse, 0.2 GeV squared inverse. This is essentially pi on mass, okay? The order. Okay? And then we have this relationship. And this is very useful. Okay? If you have 1 over Jev squared, you know that it's 0.4 millibound. 1 over Tev squared is 0.4 nanobound. So these are the scales which you set. Now, if something of the size of the PED has a geometric cross-section, you know, unitarity saturating cross-section, then the cross-section can be as large as this. That's what I said, okay? Do you understand? You know, in case of hadron, it's an extended object. You collide, if you touch, it scatters. That's unitary saturation. If it touches, it scatters. Just like all the ordinary object you have has this cross section, ping pong ball or you know baseball, anything. You collide, and then the cross section is its cross section. Yeah? And that is because no matter where you collide, you get unit one collision, right? Then the cross section appears. So that's the largest possible cross section. Okay? And that we already know here. It's very useful, right? Now, for the luminosity. Luminosity is the number of collisions per square centimeter per second. Okay? So if you have more and more beam particle, you have a larger luminosity. So you can say that, tell that this is a huge number of particles, colliding particles per square meter per second. Okay? So it's a kind of a rather big current. Now, in 1 year, 10 to the 7 second, we can tell that with the first target luminosity of 10 to the 33, we have 10 to the 40 square centimeter per year, and which is 10 inverse femtobound per year. And this is also, this is rather easy. I mean, well, you know, this 33 and 34, you know, you see in the advertisement of the LHC, right? Higher luminosity is 10 to the 34. The first target luminosity is 33. we always hear. So then it is very easy to translate into femtobarn per year. Okay. Then we know if the cross section is which femtobarn, then 10 times this femtobarn value is the number of events. Okay. And please remember that KKB, our B factory, which is 2 times 10 to the 34 luminosity. It's a world luminosity record. Okay. And it is achieved by having many electron bunches in one ring. So when one electron bunch circles, I don't remember, 20 or 30 bunches circles. No? And then all of them collide at exactly the same place. It's also extremely accurate, super technology. Okay? But in any case, LSC will do similar things. And you will hear that there is a serious discussion already started of upgrading the present LSC, which is designed to reach 10 to the 34 by having another 10 factor of 10 increase in the luminosity, 10 to the 35. Okay. That will require not only the upgrade of the collider, but also the upgrade of detector, because it means that the detectors will receive 10 times more radiation. Okay, that is very, very serious. And so that is being studied. So you may start hearing about 10 to 35 in the future. Okay. So what I wrote here is total cross section is 100 millibarn. This is summation over all the collisions. And about half of this total cross section is has multi-particle production. Usually they are called non-diffractive inelastic collisions. And that is about 50 millibarn. Okay. And you know elastic scattering. So proton-proton goes to proton-proton, but they still scatter, right? They can still scatter. And this cross-section is also very large, about 20 millibarn. And then there are still rather strange kind of scattering. Where one of the proton remains as proton, but the other proton becomes a hadronic system. Those are called single diffractive process. And then there are yet another kind of process where both protons become a hadronic system, but in between is nothing. Those are called double diffractive processes. And if we sum over everything, it adds up to about 100 millibarn. But for experiments, important thing is how many hadrons you have in the central part of the detector. The only processes where those underlying events contribute to the detector is non-diffractive inelastic processes. The cross-section is about half of this, 50 millibarn. Okay. So please remember this. Okay. And then you find that you will have 10 to the 8 collisions per second. And with higher luminosity, the target luminosity of the present LHC, 10 to the 9 collisions per second. And this is 10 to the minus 9 second of one event, so 10 to the 9 hertz, which is much too much for the standard data-taking method. Okay. So because of this, we should know, actually this is very important, you should know. Okay. For the 10 to the 33 luminosities, if we record one event. No. We can never record all these events. Okay? So we can record only in a very small fraction of those events. So all the experimental detectors have some trigger for the recording by using some interesting online information. Okay? So usually, for instance, high PT muon, okay? Or high PT electron, high PT photon, if they are isolated, they are treated. Typically, say 15 GeV or 30 GeV or higher, they are treated. And also, if jet PT is higher than, say, 30 GeV, they are triggered. Okay. So they need to trigger interesting events such that they can manage data handling, but at the same time, they don't want to lose something really important. Okay. So this triggering system is probably the most important part of the experimental detector system. And if you fail this trigger system, you construct a huge detector, huge collider that misses everything, you know. Collider can produce something very interesting, but you don't trigger it, so there is no data, okay? So when you talk to experimentalists, you always learn, try to ask them how this kind of event is triggered. If you have something in mind, some new physics in mind, okay? They may not pass through the trigger. You know, one very important and very actually extremely interesting scenario of supersymmetry is that dark matter is actually a heavy gravitino. Okay, that's possible. You know? Now, if the dark matter, lightest supersymmetric particle, is gravitino, and if it is heavy, heavy means 10 GeV, 30 GeV, if it is heavy, then the next lightest supersymmetric particle decays into gravitino by the gravity interaction, which is very small. And typically, the next lightest supersymmetric particle will have a lifetime of several hours to several days or even a half year. Okay? Now, can you detect them? No? They don't decay inside of the detector. They will just go out. Only important thing is if they are neutral, then there's no way, probably. Maybe only missing PT, but if it is heavy, it does not produce large missing PT because it produces large missing energy, okay? But energy you cannot measure at PT collisions, because almost all the energies are go through the beam pipe, right? Only a very small fraction of those 14 keV will go into hard scattering, makes PT. And only the PT balance they can measure. Okay? So if a very heavy particle with missing PT is produced, if it is very heavy, it does not give very large PT. So the signal is not so good. So one very important signal is it will be produced tragically if it is charged. Okay? So it gives a very straight trajectory. Yeah? And because it is very heavy, it has extremely big momentum. So it's kind of very strange thing. You know, it ionizes very strongly because it moves very slowly, but it doesn't bend. Just straight. So actually, in order to trigger those things, actually muon trigger is most important. It hits muon trigger because it looks like muon. But if you study, it's very different from muon. So this example, muon trigger system will catch this signal. But there may be even more exotic things. So actually, it is very important to learn about triggering system if you are interested in very exotic physics. Okay, and another thing is for each event with a 10 to the 33 luminosity, usually you have only one event inside of the record, or maybe a few events where some other collisions are inside, overlaid. Yeah, it's like a picture taking, And something moves very quickly, and the shutter speed is not very fast. Okay? You take one picture, and then several things and overlaid. That will be the data. And it will be definitely the data for 10 to the 34. Typically, 10 to 20 events will be overlaid. Okay? So you will trigger one interesting part, like one high PP something. You trigger, and you take the data, but then before closing this system, 10 or 20 events will be there. Most of them will be just soft particles, okay? But the data will be dirtier. There will be more charged particles inside of your deep data. And those will complicate the experimental analysis. So please remember, when we talk about the LHC physics, high luminosity does not always tell is a good thing. Okay? For some special analysis, higher luminosity is disadvantageous because of the more charged particles. Okay? But for some analysis, higher luminosity is better because the signal is 10 times bigger. So this is the proton model. So proton and proton collides, and protons inside the proton and proton B inside of another proton collides, make some hard scattering process, AB to CB, and the X gives hadrons. Okay? For theory students, please understand this is a well-defined leading order description of the well-defined perturbation expansion. Okay? There are many words that the leading order of the QCD perturbation theory with factorization of collinear singularities. Okay? And the factorization scale is Q here. Okay? And the factorized quantity is called Parton distribution function. And the cross-section is calculated this way. So we want to calculate PP collision to CD plus anything is there. It is calculated as summation over Parton distribution, product of Parton product distribution, A Parton having a momentum fraction X1 of the right moving proton, and B Parton, which has the momentum fraction X2 of the left-hand moving proton. Okay? And these functions are factorized, measured in other experiments, especially in the deep inelastic scattering experiments, or at lower energy Tevatron collision experiments. Okay? So these are parameterized and extrapolated. Okay? Extrapolation can be done by using perturbated QCD. Okay. Now, distributions are multiplied, then the collision invariant, collision system invariant mass is S times X1 times X2. I think I wrote it here. So PA plus PB squared is the energy square, CM energy square of the AB collision system, okay? And then it is energy minus momentum. And the energy is just a summation over two energy. So in the unit of proton energy, which is square root of S over two, 7 PV, okay? 7 TV is the proton energy. S is 14 TV squared. Okay? So in this unit, it is X1 plus X2 is the total energy. And the momentum is, right moving one is, say, positive, and left moving one is, say, negative. So then it is X1 minus X2 is the momentum. Okay? And you calculate this, and you find 4 times x1 times x2. So you find that s hat is s times x1 times x2. I use tau for x1 times x2. Okay? So a momentum fraction is always between 0 and 1. So the product of the x1 and x2 is also between 0 and 1, which is consistent. Okay? You can never produce something more heavier than pt, total energy. And of course, you can in principle produce zero mass particle. And well, probably in the back side you cannot see the lower lines, so please let me go up a little bit. I wrote exactly the same equations by using this variable. Okay, tau is the ratio of the invariant mass squared. Okay, the partonic invariant mass squared versus the proton invariant mass squared. Okay, and then x1 and x2. X1 and X2 can be parameterized this way. It is very easy because X1 times X2 is tau, that we already know. And Y, exponential Y, Y is just the rapidity of the parton-parton AB system. Please study rapidity. Of course, I can do it here if you have questions. Rapidity is the velocity-like variable for Lorentz boost. Okay. Let me see. For everybody knows that the Lorentz transformation is a mixture of rotation and boost. And actually, if you study carefully, you know that both rotation and boost are SU2. Okay, so the Lorentz transformation can be expressed as a product of SU2 plus SU2. Now, it means that for rotation, you have angles, right? Rotation angle, if you make two rotations, you just sum rotations, right? So in some sense, the rotation can be linearized in terms of the angular variable. You do exactly the same for boost. Okay, you do the boost in the same direction, the consecutive effect of the two boosts can be sum over sum of the two rapidities. That's how rapidity is defined. Okay. And so you just make boost and then you find that this rapidity is just changed by a constant. It is very useful in collider experiments because we never know the central mass frame of the collisions. It's rather difficult. We sometimes know, okay? But when we change x1 and x2, but still the product of x1 times x2 is the same, we can produce same thing, right? But the produced thing moves along the z direction, along the proton-proton direction, okay? And this is just a shift in the rapidity. So within the experimental detector acceptance, it is good to sum over those rapidities and then study the events in terms of the invariant mass or the PT variable, which is boost invariant. Okay, PT is important because it is not affected by the boost along the proton beam. Okay. So we always use PT variable and the rapidity variable. And rapidity requires the knowledge of the mass of the particle. On the other hand, high energy detector, it is extremely difficult to measure the mass. Okay? Of course, KKB, Bele, can do it. Okay? But that's very low energy. They can distinguish pion from kaon from proton. That's very important for them. Okay? But unfortunately, neither ATLAS nor CMS we'll be able to distinguish pi k p because they're just almost the same velocity always. too high energy. Okay? So the velocity is the same, then the ionization is the same. There's no way to distinguish them. Okay? So the point is, we will never know the mass or the particle. Okay? So instead, they use an angular variable, which is called pseudo rapidity, which is obtained from the rapidity by removing the mass. Okay? So it is not exactly Boost invariant, but still approximately so at high energy limit. So I do not, in the following, I do not distinguish pseudo rapidity from rapidity, but I usually use correct rapidity by y and pseudo rapidity by eta. And I think many theorists just follow this kind of convention. But experimentally, only the pseudo rapidity can be measured. So in any case, rapidity is defined as one half of the logarithm of energy plus boost direction momentum and over energy minus boost direction momentum. Okay? And then it's just a logarithm of x1 over x2. And by using these variables, we can write the product dx1 dx2, this one, in terms of d tau and dy. This is very nice. I mean, Jacobian is just one. You can just follow it. Okay? And as I told you, it is always useful to integrate over rapidity, yeah, because exactly the same thing can be produced. Okay? So it is very useful to write the I promised I should put it above, okay? Maybe like this. So the cross-section can be written in terms of tau, you know, invariant mass integral, and the integral of the rapidity of the product of the parton distribution, and the sub-process cross-section. So this is the most convenient expression for us, for theorists to study what is roughly measured by experiments. For experimentalists, it is slightly more difficult because you know, this rapidity integral can extend over the range, outside of the range of the detector. Okay. The detector, typical detector at the LHC covers the pseudo rapidity, it's just an angle of say about 2.5 for electrons, muons, and photons, okay? And about 5, okay? From minus 5 to 5, that's very, very large. For hadronic jets, okay. But outside they cannot measure. Okay. So it is rather more difficult. But for theorists, probably this is a good starting. And it is very useful to have this quantity because you know we can rather easily calculate a sub-process cross section for any processes. I will tell you how to calculate this data. But then it is multiplied by parton-parton luminosity function, which is defined here. And then integrate over the energy. Okay? This cross-section depends on the energy. This is essentially the parton energy. Okay? And I think it is useful to have this table of this quantity. And actually, a few days ago, I asked my student to make this table. And I think, unfortunately, it was not really correct. So I could not copy everything. But I think that many of those numbers look okay to me. So probably these numbers are fine. So here, you know, this dl over d tau is those numbers. Okay, and a dot b is here, okay? And this is defined as a product of this. And if a is not b, then A and B is interchanged and add added. Okay? It is simply because, you know, let's count that. I mean, right moving proton is A proton, but it can also be B proton inside of the right moving proton, right? So you should, actually, you should multiply by 2. But if A is the same, then you double count. Okay, so you should not do that. So it is a case for gluon. Okay. Yeah, gluon is gluon. So you should not multiply by 2. Okay. Yeah, please think carefully about those things, statistics. And in any case, important thing we learn is if we are interested in the energy, photon-photon energy, gluon-gluon collision energy at 120 GeV, you know, I'm thinking of Higgs boson production from gluon-gluon fusion at 120 GeV. Okay, and then we know the Higgs, two gluon to Higgs boson cross section. It's a complicated thing, bundled diagram. It's a small cross section, but it will be multiplied by this factor for one proton-proton collision. Okay, that's good. It's very good. I mean, I don't know how to count it. 2 million? Yes, 2 million. Okay. Ah, I have two numbers because we can choose a factorization scale, okay, in a different manner. And in case of, for instance, gluon-gluon to Higgs boson production, correct factorization scale we should choose is a square root of SR. So this is the rule where we should be. There are many cases where it is important to have a T-channel weak boson exchange processes are important. Then in those cases, often factorization scale of MW is more important, even at very, very high energies. So I also have a Q equal MW here. Although for gluon-gluon case, this blue line is never important. Now, and actually you can tell that at 300 GeV, the number becomes 72,000, and at 1 TeV, it's only 300, okay? And that's actually the reason that gluon-gluon fusion contribution to Higgs boson production drops very quickly with the mass of the Higgs boson. And it is essentially because of the decrease of the gluon-gluon luminosity. Now, let's gluon and upquark and gluon QQ bar, those are also important, but let's study UUUDDD, okay? Because these turned out to be very important. Unfortunately, probably it is rather difficult, and I should keep this number so I can move a little bit above, and then, well, these don't change so much, okay? So I hope their number is correct. UU collision does not decrease so quickly. This is what I wanted to recognize. Okay, of course it is large at 120 GeV, but only a factor of 10 smaller at 300, another factor of 10 smaller for at 1 TeV, and only a factor of 40 or so smaller at 3 TeV. So it decreases rather slowly. And this is because upquark inside of the proton has much harder distribution. There are more hard upquark inside of proton. And because of this, at large X, upquark is more copious, more frequently observed than the gluon. At small x, gluon is much more copious. Okay? And I will show the distribution later, but it is a reflection of this. And actually, because of this, valence quark collisions at very high collision energy is not so small. Okay? And those are rather important. And UD is also important. And when we produce Higgs boson, actually, from the W boson fusion, this UD process is actually most important because UD goes to DU plus Higgs boson by exchanging W boson. The point is, you can emit W plus to become a down quark, and down quark can emit W minus to become up quark, and this W plus and W minus collides to make a Higgs boson. Okay? So this is very important, and I hope it's okay. these are very easy for you to check, so please try to make this kind of table yourself, and then start thinking yourself. Okay? And this value is obtained from this Parton distributions. There are two groups of Parton distribution makers. One maker is American, CTEC, and another maker is called MRS. It's from Durham University in England. Okay. But in any case, if you look at their homepage, you find a bunch of Parton distributions. And of course, we have no idea which one to use, so you look for some famous experimentalist talk or something, and then you learn which distribution they are using, and then we just use it. I do not know too much about Parton distribution functions. There are so many differences. Okay? But when you need to know the uncertainty in the predictions of the theory for the production cross-section, then actually those differences in the Parton distribution become most important. Okay? Because all the different Parton distributions in some way fit the present, the available data. Okay? All of them fit the present data. Okay? So it means that it is possible to fit the present data by those various Parton distributions. It means that our prediction will be uncertain. You know, by switching, you know, those distributions, you have different predictions, and those are intrinsic uncertainty in a prediction. Okay. And that is very important. And that's why, actually, it is very important to have two groups, at least. It's better to have even three, third group, but in any case, you know, if those uncertainties are there, it's rather good to have a completely independent parametrization. So I think it is very useful to have those parametrizations. And but when you study those things, one is sufficient, anything. Another, probably because I told you about Parton distribution uncertainties, please let me tell you this, okay? I personally believe that there is no worry about the uncertainty in the Parton distribution, no matter what you want to discover at LHC. I have a rather strong opinion on this. This is because the LHC experiment itself will be able to measure those distributions, whether independently or even dependent, even together with the new physics, by using the information we already know. The most important thing is actually for us to understand the standard model background for all the new physics contribution. That is very important. But the Parton distribution uncertainty is just a part of the uncertainty in the standard model predictions for the background. It is only a part of it. Major uncertainty is actually in jet physics. Okay? And all those included, all these uncertainties should be fine-tuned or should be understood by using the Tevatron data. By using the Tevatron data now, but most importantly, by using the LHC data itself. Actually, we will find that it is good to have a Tevatron data to fine-tune sort of several things, but the extrapolation from 2 TeV to 14 TeV is so huge that you can never believe in the extrapolation. So actually, the right strategy is to use the LHC data itself to understand the standard model background and by using the QCD tools. Okay. And PDF uncertainties is just part of it. And when we are doing it, it will be automatically adjusted. So I do not think there's any worry about this. Even though there is a significant uncertainty at this moment, that you know, even if the observation that the LHC significantly differs with this prediction by using PDF, nobody worries. It's just a change of distribution and other random model contribution. Okay, now comes to the part on distribution functions. And actually, this is what, you know, the student who made this table have never used the Parton distribution before. He told me. So I told him that, that's worrying. So I told him that first, please check the sum rule, okay? So that he knows that he is calling the right thing for making this distribution, okay? So this is very easy. This sum rule tells that if we sum over the energy of all the partons inside of the proton, it should adapt to proton energy. That sounds very reasonable, right? Yeah, that's actually how we define the proton distribution at the starting place. That's a factorization scheme. Okay? But in any case, this is strictly obeyed in all the parameterizations. Okay? So it means that this is a parton distribution, and x is the momentum fraction. We multiply x and then integrate from 0 to 1. And then sum over all the partons, okay? Gluon, UU bar, DD bar, SS bar, CC bar, DD bar. There is no top inside the proton, at least up to LHC. Hopcock distribution is never important. Okay? But Peacock distribution is important, you will see. Okay? Now it adds up to 1. So at Q equals factorization scale of 2 MW and 1 TeV, he calculated by using this distribution, parameterization. He found that gluon is 40%, up quark 30%, down quark 16%, U bar, D bar, S and S bar 10%, C and C bar 0.9%, no B, and you sum up and it's 1. So at least he checked that he's calling the right thing. And then it's rather interesting to see at high factorization scale, the gluon fraction gradually grows. Okay? So at 1 TeV, it is almost half in energy. Upcoke decreases because the valence coke is less and less important at high factorization scale. Downcoke also decreases. But C-coke increases, okay? Charm-coke increases dramatically, and B-coke also, yeah? And they also add up to 1. In 3 digits, it's okay. And another sum rule you can check, which is important only at low energy, is the valence coke sum rule. It's also very nice. Upcoke distribution inside the proton minus anti-upcoke distribution inside the proton, you subtract and integrate, it should be 2, always. The reason is very simple. You know, you start with the assumption that there is 2 upcoke and 1 downcoke inside the proton. Okay? That's a definition of proton in this language. Now, you use only QCD perturbation theory. Okay? To radiate off quarks and gluons. Now, there are only two types of splitting. Up coke splits into coke and glue. But if you start with up coke, you always have up coke at the end. Okay? Up coke number is conserved in QCD. Now, you start from gluon, you produce U and U bar. If you produce U, you always produce U bar. This is also up coke number conservation, because U minus U bar is always zero. So this quantity never changes by emission of gluons. Changing of the factorization scale simply means that you emit, more and more you emit gluons and coke radiation. So this is also useful to check. And once these are satisfied, actually you can convince yourself that you are calling the right distribution. Because sometimes you are not so sure if the quantity is tells a Parton distribution which enters the luminosity, or the Parton energy fraction. You can multiply x, but only after multiplying x, you have this some energy summary. If you do not multiply, then actually you find divergence, because the number of protons inside the proton is infinity. Okay? And that's where this saturation of quarks and gluons enters. Okay? That's a very interesting small x physics, which I do not touch in my lecture. So this is this distribution. It looks very nice. This is the starting distribution. So this is at the factorization scale of 1 GeV in the CTEC parameterization. You roughly see up coke is here, and zero, this is strange, 0, 1, I'm sorry, it is x times, sorry. It is x times the Parton distribution, so the energy fraction distribution. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, I first thought it is a Parton distribution. Then, of course, the area under up coke should be 2, right? And it is much smaller than 2, so I was confused. And then I realized it is x times the Parton distribution. Then it is smaller than 1. It's fine. So the point is integration of over all the area should add up to 1. Roughly, it's okay, right? This area plus this area plus this area plus this area is almost 1. 1 times 1 is 1, right? So you roughly know that it's okay. Now, at high factorization scale, very different. So this is at 120 GeV, okay? So you see gluon here, okay? So it's impossible to show this in one time. So up coke is much softer now, okay? But still, you know, integration over here plus integration over this. This is gluon, okay? And this, I think this is C coke, and this is probably charm, and this is bottom. Now we have bottom here. This yellow thing is probably bottom. Okay? And we add up all the areas. Yeah, including those areas, and I think it becomes 1. At even higher factorization scale, now this is 5, and so you know, there is a very high factorization. This is 1 TeV. Okay? If you do 1 TeV parton-parton collision, to produce 1 PT, PT, high PT, I mean PT equals 1 TeV jet, okay? Then this is the distribution which enters in your calculation, okay? Essentially Q, factorization Q is a PT scale of the physics, okay? And then you find that still upcoke is important, but still, you know, it's much softer than before. And U, D, gluon, and C-coke, charm, and bottom. So, but it is all important for you to know roughly the distribution is like this, but in practice, the numbers of those luminosity tables is probably more useful because you have right orders of luminosity. From here, very qualitative thing you can learn, but not the quantitative thing. Sorry, what is the time?
So, we still have 20 minutes.
Okay, fine. So in the last part of my handwriting, it's not really the last, but here, I wrote probably experts will not be happy about this, but I think this is useful. Okay? The cross-section, you know, I wrote the proton-proton cross-section as a product of convolution integral in terms of tau integral, which is essentially the proton-proton energy integral times proton-proton luminosity times proton-proton collision cross-section. Okay? And this proton-proton collision cross-section is here, which is just a function of S hat, which is S times tau. So once we know tau, we know S hat. Okay? Now, so this is a flux factor, the matrix element squared, and if it is two-body, it's 1 over 8 pi. It's very simple. If you are producing something heavy, this should be modified, okay, by some factor of momentum to the power. Okay? And matrix element for two-body process is actually in this normalization. Actually, when I define the flux in this way, and also I define the two-body phase space this way. Actually, the matrix element has mass dimension, which depends on the number of particles produced. Okay. And if when two particles produced, actually, I mean, for two to two processes, the amplitude is dimensionless. It's very easy. And you have I just wrote two cases. One is gluon exchange, one is W exchange. Then the amplitude is essentially strong interaction squared is the amplitude, GS. For weak interactions, it is weak interaction coupling squared. And G squared is 4 pi alpha s. That's the definition of alpha s. GW squared is 4 pi alpha w, which is a definition of alpha w. So it is 16 pi square alpha s square, 16 pi square alpha w square. Yeah. That's very easy. And I should say that this is not a bad approximation. Okay, please don't ask me about factors, but the order is okay. Yeah. And then, you know, by using TeV units, okay, and here is a skeletal SAT, okay. So if the square root of SAT is TV, it's just pi over 1 TV squared, and so alpha S squared or alpha V squared, and then you just calculate it, and we already know that, you know, J minus squared is, I forgot, some millibar or something, right? So TV minus squared, you can easily calculate it, and you find 10 to the 3 femtopower. Okay? And then times alpha S squared, alpha V squared. Not two small factors. And you roughly know that at TV scale, we have several like a 10-fold or even bigger for strong interactions. But for weak interaction, it is can be a few femtobarn. And that's then with 10 inverse femtobarn, you know how many things you can produce. So this is how very roughly we can calculate the cross section. And if you want to calculate exactly, you can do it by hand, by hard work, or you can. There are many automatized matrix element calculators. So you just call them, and just ask them to calculate, and it's done. But it is useful for you to know the rough estimate this way. Now for single particle production, the story is very different. And here I wrote it for A, B to C. And the flux is the same, matrix element is the same, but the one-body phase space is delta function. I did not give any covariant definition of the phase space and the matrix element, but I think this is a very standard definition of the phase space and the matrix element. And because you know always the matrix element, the phase space comes one to each other. So once we define here, we define here. Okay. So the product is always the same. So in any case, this is the one-body phase space, and this is the matrix element. It's like this, and now it is one power of the coupling, whatever. Okay, and so it will be something like this. So rather than alpha s squared, we will have 4 pi alpha s, 4 pi alpha w. And now it has energy moment, energy scale, which is essentially s half. And then we just multiply this and we find this. And we can write in this way. And we find that there is a rather big number here, 10 to the 5 femtobarn times this delta function. And this delta function is just tells that when we integrate over tau, this is replaced by 1. And the cross-section will become just a product of parton-parton luminosity times this number, right? Do you understand? And this number is rather big, quite interesting. So if there is a single resonance produced, actually the cross-section is very large. And of course, Higgs boson is not really this, because it does not have three-level couplings. So this amplitude is very small. Okay? So because this amplitude is very small, this part is very small. And because of that, we have a moderate cross-section. But still, because it is a single resonance production, we have some very large enhancement factor. Okay. And also, if we have, for instance, new Z boson, then it is essentially something like this, right? New Z boson coupling will be similar to weak boson coupling. So actually, we will have this times this for new Z boson production at some scale. And then the luminosity is same. UU bar, DD bar, SS bar, okay, will produce new Z boson. And then actually you can easily calculate this. And then you can count the number of events, roughly. So from here, you can immediately tell that the discovery of new Z boson, a new W boson, which decays into electron and muon, with a significant branching fraction, will be one of the first things to be observed because it's a single resonance product. Okay. So always, single resonance production is very, very good for any collision experiment. But yeah, so you can understand it just by comparing these two examples. Now? This is from Professor Gao. Very nice. Oh, but I cannot show. This is an enlarged version of the Higgs production cross-section. And gluon-gluon fusion is like here, which is the largest. And I told you that around 100 GeV, it is about several tens, say 30 picopan. Okay? And actually, this structure is coming from the structure of the Van der Waals amplitude from photon-photon to Higgs boson. And, sorry, gluon-gluon to Higgs boson. And gluon-gluon can couple to Higgs boson through massive particles, because the Higgs boson couples only to the massive particles. Okay? And the particle which has strong coupling constant at the same time having a large coupling to the Higgs boson is a Topkov. So it is essentially the Topkov loop, gluon-gluon collides and produce TT bar, and this TT bar annihilates to make a Higgs boson. This is a diagram which is written here. Okay? Now, it's a S-channel production Higgs boson. Near the TT bar threshold, there is actually an enhancement, because T and T bar have an S-channel resonance, which is called eta T, which is a J equals zero resonance. Okay, and because of this, for H zero it should be P wave, so it is not S wave. So sorry, but in any case, when T and T bar are very slow, there is an enhancement in this diagram, and which gives this enhancement factor. Around here should be TT bar threshold. Okay, around 400 GeV, it is, TT bar threshold is 350. Okay? So it's roughly this place. Now for HQQ is here, okay? I told you that B coke, down coke becomes up coke and produce W minus. Up coke becomes down coke by producing W plus, and W minus W plus fusion to become Higgs boson. This cross section is the second largest one. Okay, and then the standard, you know, at the LEP collider, E plus E minus collider, we looked for Higgs boson in the channel where E plus E minus annihilates, become virtual Z boson, and then splits into Z boson and Higgs boson. Okay? E plus E minus to Z boson Higgs. Very similarly, this process, QQ bar annihilates into W and Z, produces Higgs boson and W and Z. This is the standard process in E plus E minus annihilation, and also the dominant process for the Tevatron Higgs search. Okay? At Tevatron, they are looking for Higgs and W and Higgs decay into BB bar. Okay? And this cross section is around here. It's rather small. Okay? And even smaller, this TT bar Higgs is here. Okay? And in my lecture in the afternoon, I will tell you that this process will be very useful to discover Higgs boson if Higgs boson decays into two photons, or mu plus mu minus, or lepton pair, four leptons. Then this is useful, but otherwise it's very useful. Okay? Only very small fraction of the time this large cross-section will be useful. This case, QQ to QQH, it will be useful when Higgs boson decays into two photons, tau pair, and also to WW star, electron pair plus neutrino. And it will be also useful for four leptons. Now, unfortunately, this process turned out to be almost not very useful, at least around here where we are most interested in. And even though the cross-section is very small, you know, this TT bar Higgs is very small, okay? It's the smallest, around 100 GeV. But this one will be detected. And the reason I will explain in a later lecture, okay? It is because of the LHC. At the LHC, we need to have a very clean trigger, okay? The LHC, those events should be recorded only when it is triggered. The trigger requires high PT electrons, high PT muons, high PT photons, or high PT, large missing PT, or high PT jets, okay? Those are required. If it is not for those, you cannot discover it. And another thing is, you know, most of these H will decay into BB bar here. Okay? But then you calculate BB bar cross-section in the standard model. Then you find the BB bar cross-section in the standard model is around here. Two or three orders of magnitude higher. So it's completely swamped by the background. Okay? And those are the conditions. So all those conditions are rather important for you to learn. And I think it is probably most important for you to understand those basics by studying those Higgs production physics. Because the prime target of the LHC, you know, kind of sure target of the LHC, is to understand or uncover the physics of electroweak symmetry breaking. It is essentially the study of the Higgs boson properties and its family. And the very first thing you should do is to discover the Higgs boson. Okay? Once you discover the Higgs boson, you can really start studying electroweak symmetry breaking physics. Okay? Discovery is just a starting. Okay? Now, then you should start studying its coupling masses and its families, its friends. Okay? And otherwise, we will never know how really the symmetry is broken. Okay? And because of this, I think it is most useful to study all these. And then, essentially, you can learn the typical things which you should understand when you learn from the LHC physics. Okay? But before closing this morning session, I want to tell you another thing, you know. It will turn out that if Higgs boson mass is around here, it's a rather large cross-section, and if Higgs boson mass is heavier than twice the Z boson mass, okay, it means heavier than 200 GeV, 180 GeV. So everywhere from here to there, the cross-section is very large, and they decay into Z boson pair. Z boson decay into lepton, charged lepton pair. It means that Higgs boson decays significantly into four leptons, four charged leptons. And those are the cleanest channels, okay? Especially for four muons, there's essentially no background, okay? So the point is, if Higgs boson is around here, we will hear the discovery of the Higgs boson from LHC people in the first few months. Okay? That's an extremely bad news for us, no? Kind of Susie is dead or something. But of course, it's a great chance for us. But in any case, at this moment, we don't have a really greater idea as compared to the Suzy, but so it is a great opportunity for us. But you know, if X boson mass is around here, and if it is standard model like, we will hear the discovery news at very early stage. And also, the very first thing we will hear about Higgs boson from the LHC people, maybe after 1 year, is probably that they exclude, there is no Higgs boson in this region. Exactly the same reason. Yeah? Because all what I am going to tell you about the Higgs boson search in this narrow range, which we want to have, okay, from the supersymmetric unification dogma, okay, it is rather difficult. I think that the 1 full year or 2-3 years will be needed to discover the Higgs boson. Okay? So it will be rather slow. So in this scenario of supersymmetry, okay, if Skok and Gluinos are reasonably light, say 500 GeV, then actually the cross-section is huge. No? Very large, much bigger than, in case of Gluino pair, much bigger than the Kork. So actually it is possible that some kind of anomaly, anomalously huge, large missing PT events are found. Yeah? Something like that can also happen in the first half year. Okay, but if the Suzy particle is all TV or so, it will be very slow. Okay, so all those things you should bear in mind. And but still, in order for, you know, even if you have early discovery, at the very end you need to do very careful analysis, and then you should go through all the details which I am going to tell in the next lecture in the afternoon. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks Professor Hagiwara, gave us a very clear talk on the especially, I think this talk may be especially useful for the students from the IHAP. Now it's time for the questions before lunch.
Production from two gluon is much smaller than QQ bar to HQQ bar. I mean HQQ and gluon contribution as we see from the data diagram, Feynman diagram from two quark to H zero and two quark. And W four is an electrolytic product, and the APT is strong interaction. Why HTT bar production is much smaller than HQQ. Yeah, I don't know if I'm expressing myself very well.
This is not so easy, but first of all, HQQ is large because essentially the coupling is a gauge coupling here. Okay? And at the same time, there is a T-channel weak boson exchange here, which has an enhancement factor. And actually, it is not so easy to explain to you here. And one way of explaining is that in this scattering with T-channel exchange of vector bosons, we have a contribution from very large orbital angular momentum. So in some sense, when Q and Q are somehow far away, you can still collide because large angular momentum contribution can give contribution to the cross-section. For instance, in this case, these two gluons can collide only when it is head-on, because it is S-wave, right? It should produce spin zero particle. Yeah? Yeah. Now, in case of this, it is a T-channel fermion exchange. So there, actually, there is no big enhancement factor for fermion exchange. And it's not so easy to explain the difference between vector boson exchange and fermion exchange. In some sense, vector boson exchange can give you constant cross-section. But the fermion exchange always gives you 1 over square root of S suppressed at high energies. So there is a big factor. And another thing is here, top cork Yukawa coupling is rather large. But when you study BB bar, if you replace the top cork by BB bar, it gains when the Higgs boson is light, because BB bar is also light. But because the coupling is small, it is much smaller than TT bar A. This is the difference is just the coupling difference. Yeah. Because it is rather difficult to explain all of this.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, I see no questions.
Now suppose we discover a particle with mass of around 200 GeV, which is supposed to be the Higgs boson. Of course, it is close to the prediction value of the standard model, but it is not. It is out of the range which standard model can stand to be right. So we have to consider some new models or new theories. So I think the one important question is how to distinguish a Higgs boson, which is an elementary particle or a composite. Thank you.
One important thing is that if the Higgs boson mass turned out to be 200 GeV, then a simple granularification picture breaks down. So probably SUSY is not good. On the other hand, standard model is probably okay, because 200 GeV is around the bound limit of the accepted value for the minimal standard model from the electric precision data. Okay? So actually, if the Higgs boson turned out to be around 200 GeV, immediately we cannot tell where the new physics is. Yeah. So we should measure the Higgs boson couplings very carefully and look for its partner. And it is likely that we do need to have a linear collider for precision measurement of the Higgs boson properties. Because at Hadron colliders, all the measurements will have limitations about 10%. Okay. And that is probably not enough for really understanding the nature of this Higgs boson.
So we still need data from the ILC?
I would think so. But on the other hand, if the Higgs boson turned out to be, so say, 500 or 600 GeV, then we all already know that it is incompatible with the electric precision measurement we already know of. Okay? It means that we do need to have new particles. We already know at the very moment when Higgs boson mass turned out to be 500 GeV or so, we already know that there should be some new particle which receives masses from the symmetry breaking sector, and at the same time they should couple to W or Z or both, because otherwise they cannot affect the electric precision measurement. In order to compensate for the large Higgs boson mass effect. So that is probably easier situation, because the discovery tells us anomaly, already a deviation from the standard model. But if Higgs boson mass is around between, say, 140 GeV and 200 GeV or so, it's most ambiguous, you know. There's no immediate discrepancy with the presented precision data. On the other hand, it's only theoretical that we don't like fine tunings, right? Mm-hmm. So I think further experimental studies on its detailed property will be necessary.
Any further questions? Okay, if no questions, now let's thank speaker again.